Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about the upcoming art program called Occam's Razor, which is at Santa Fe Complex. And we're going to be talking to Denise Cope about her new book, Dying a Natural Passage. Right now, I would like to welcome John Kennedy. He is the artistic director of Santa Fe New Music, and he is going to be teaching a six-part lecture series called Beyond the Noise, Listening to Modern Music. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here, too. This is at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. It starts October 16th. It's an evening class. It's six sessions that run through the beginning of December. Now, Beyond the Noise, modern music has sort of a reputation for being a little bit noisy. Is that right?
There can be, yeah. Contemporary music and modern music has grown to encompass everything, including noise, including all different kinds of sounds. Of course, it embraces all genres, too, and all different kinds of music that are most consonant and beautiful, as well as the dissonant.
You are basing the course in part on a book by he's a MacArthur Fellow, a Genius Award laureate named Alex Ross, who wrote a book called The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. Where does this book start? What did it give you as an inspiration to teach this class?
Well, it's interesting. This book is so long overdue as a sort of a narrative history for non-musicians telling the story of 20th century music. Ross has been the music critic for The New Yorker for many years, and he's also written freelance for The New York Times. And he has a wonderful way of telling the story of music through composers' lives. And the book has really been very welcome just in as a general read, too. I mean, it was on the Times top 10 bestseller list for a while, you know, which is sort of extraordinary that a book like that would grow beyond a niche audience. And a lot of it came out last year. A lot of people in our audience have been asking me about the book and saying, have you read the book? And I'm saying, of course I have. And
So what does it give? And
folks have said, well, could you teach a course about it? And so it, one thing led to another. What does it give? Well, you know, it starts like in 1906 with the performance of Salome in Graz, Austria. And it goes through most of Ross's book focuses on the first 50 years of the 20th century, up through World War II. And then in the second half of the book, he gives a pretty quick overview of the things that have happened since World War II to the present. And what is great about Ross's writing is it's very readable. It's a narrative story, and it really sends the message that composers matter, that these are not artist heroes that we had in, you know, or a conception of in the past, that these are real people who had incredible problems, who ran into problems with their government in many cases, like the Soviet composers, even Aaron Copland in the United States, and that these people, to keep their creative vision alive in telling the story of the 20th century through their music, it was a tremendous, gripping story. And because you know, what we do with Santa Fe New Music, we present really more than music of our time, you know, that like the last generation or two of music. We occasionally do something older than that.
And therefore, you've got living composers and performers who are extremely creative people,
yeah,
of whom we're going to have another one on the air tomorrow.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and so what we wanted to do with this lecture series was to bring Ross's story even more into the present and provide a greater focus on the music of the last 50 years in particular. And so in the series, it's over six lectures. I sort of will be going through his book for the most part in the first 2.5 lectures. And then the second 3.5, I'll really be going into much more detail about the composers who I think are most important in the last 50 years.
So let's talk about the first half of the 20th century. What happened both culturally and musically, and what was the relationship between those two things that made for a whole break from the 19th century?
Yeah, well, so much had happened in the 19th century, you know, mostly in the Germanic tradition with Wagner and then Strauss, leading up to like what we think of as like the end of tonality, and or a change in tonality, where Schoenberg then came up like with the 12-tone system in the early 20th century. And that was such a signal moment in music history, because for many people, and many music lovers today, it's like they don't want to listen to anything after that. And, you know, a lot of factors were involved, all the intellectual ferment in Vienna at the time of trying to come up with some sort of order to our psychology and coming up with a way of writing music that was maybe not so extroverted and subjective, but that actually had a system to it. You know, and many of these composers, I mean, and Ross talks about this in his book, they led miserable lives. They were in the midst of all kinds of horrible things going on in the world. And for composers like Schoenberg and others, the idea of could create an artificial order to express themselves. It was like a psychological device. And
a lot of composers had miserable lives in the 17th century, in the
18th. Of course, yeah. But, you know, I mean, there was also this incredible weight of history. You know, it's like classical music sort of developed this sense of, you know, that forward motion, that everything had to go in a certain direction. I mean, that was very Germanic as well. And a lot of things really collided at that moment to open up the music world, where so many people were doing different kinds of things that were much more non-dogmatic than, say, the kind of 12-tone school that everyone associates with a lot of 20th century music. And so part of the story we'll try to tell is that you know, there are actually many, many streams to contemporary music, not just the ones that have sort of stereotypically become prominent.
Now, some of those streams are what your average person might call more listenable than others.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What makes something more listenable than something else?
Well, that's sort of in the ears of the beholder, I guess. You know?
Is it just totally in the ears of the beholder?
Well, no. I mean, on a certain level, you can refer to certain acoustic studies that will tell you that, yes, clashing intervals do provide more psychological distress than consonant ones. You know, that's a physical fact. On the other hand, there's a way to listen, and there's tremendous amount of consonants even in dissonant music if you know how to hear it. You know, if you've trained your ears a little bit, if you've developed an acquired taste. But sometimes it
reminds me of, for example, there's schools of photorealist art that makes big paintings of rotten orange peels and garbage under the sewer grate, and suddenly
sure.
It's beautiful for a minute. And
right.
You wonder, what's going on there?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, in music, I mean, there have been many composers in the last 100 years who have worked in all different kinds of styles. I mean, the influence of world music and the music of other cultures and the classical music of other cultures have influenced a lot of composers. I mean, from Bartok to Messiaen to the American minimalists today, like Phil Glass and Steve Reich. And, you know, this is music that, you know, a lot of people find incredibly tuneful and listenable.
In the 19th century and every century before that, in the European classical tradition, there was an interaction between folk music of the time and quote-unquote high art or classical mm-hmm. music. Where are we at with that today?
It still goes on all the time. I mean, that's something that composers have always used in terms of using the vernacular music around them and incorporating it. You know, one of the big mythologies, I think, in the history of Western music is like Stravinsky's Rite of Spring was so radical. Well, in the last generation, musicologists have shown that even the Rite of Spring is derived from Russian folk material.
Right.
You know, and it's really just sort of like Rimsky-Korsakov on steroids, you know. And it's not so hard to listen to, frankly. And especially in our day and age where everyone's exposed to movie soundtracks and all those kinds of things. Stravinsky's a piece of cake. And, you know, today, I mean, a lot of composers are, you know, still derive material from whether, you know, different musical traditions they study, like the composer we presented last year, Ingram Marshall, very involved in Indonesian music. And Peter Garland, a composer who we're presenting this coming Saturday, has studied folk musics around the world, particularly in Mexico, and involved those sorts of things in his work. And it's not a deliberate attempt to go out and necessarily be exotic or to appropriate something else, but it's the musical tools, it's the vocabulary, it's those little bits and pieces that composers use in creating their own personal aesthetic.
We're talking to John Kennedy, the artistic director of Santa Fe New Music, about the upcoming six-part lecture series, Beyond the Noise, Listening to Modern Music. One thing I have noticed, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is that it is whatever contemporary, modern, classical, new music you have is eminently non-danceable. It might have some beats here and there, but they go away before you can establish a groove in your body.
Well, you know, that's true of a lot of concert music. I can accept that sort of as a generalization, except so many contemporary dance companies use a lot of music by contemporary composers. I mean, you know, there's a lot going on in, from, you know, like Sarah Rudner and Twyla Tharp, Mark Morris and others who in New York City Ballet has a tremendous tradition of commissioning new music. So, I mean, when composers are asked to write for dance, I think they can still, as much as anyone else in the past did, write music that's danceable.
Now, that's danceable by trained performers as opposed to somebody in a club saying, "Ooh, I want to dance to this."
Right. You know, there's so much...
It's not a judgment. Yeah. It's just a question.
No, I mean, but, you know, I mean, one of the things that composers have done in the last 100 years is also play with rhythmic devices and, you know, make their rhythms more complex. And, I mean, there's no reason that, say, a pulse-driven composer like Philip Glass, you really could dance to that. And, I mean, many choreographers did use that music. But a lot of composers like to work with a different kind of rhythmic complexity so that it becomes a kind of texture and that, you know, our lives don't always move to a steady beat. And so if their music reflects other elements of life, that sort of textural element that's less periodic is a metaphor for that.
Well, and one does wonder how much the music of the 20th century, now the 21st century, reflects a kind of fragmented and urban and weirdly multicultural, multisensual life that we all live.
Oh, definitely. I mean, an even uncentered and unknown kind of life we have now, a culture that's really fragmented. And so, you know, there are composers who write music today that is very fragmented, that's skittish, that jumps from idea to idea. Some of that's deliberate by a good composer. Some of it might be less accomplished by a composer who doesn't know what they're doing. You know, they become a reflection of our fragmentation.
All this and much, much more can be learned and taken in and discussed at this lecture series that you are doing, Beyond the Noise, Listening to Modern Music. The course runs from October 16th until December 4th. It's from 6 to 7:30. Is it at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum?
Well, it's at their education annex on Grant Avenue.
And how do people find out more about it?
They should call the O'Keeffe Museum at 946-1039 or visit the O'Keeffe Museum website or Santa Fe New Music's website.
And Santa Fe New Music is sfnm.org.
That's correct.
John Kennedy, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Suzanne Vilmaine and Stephen Smith. They are involved in the exhibition that's coming up, Occam's Razor, Simple Yet No Simpler, which is opening on October 18th, from 4 to 8 at Santa Fe Complex. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So Occam's Razor, as a concept for an art exhibition, what, Steve, is Occam's Razor? What is that concept?
Well, I can't really speak to it from an art perspective. From a science perspective, it's really a pre-science concept. It's what's considered to sort of be the first, the beginnings of what became the scientific method.
And what do you mean? What does Occam's Razor say?
Well, the original quote from William of Ockham would be in Old English, but essentially that all things being equal, the simplest explanation is the best.
What are some examples of that from the history of science?
Well, at the time, the most obvious example to me is is when we went from the perspective of the Earth as being the center of the universe to a solar-centric center of the universe, that the explanations required to account for all of the perturbations and the motions of the planets were, they got very elaborate. The more we measured, the more we realized that there were more details to take care of, and when somebody finally acknowledged that you didn't have to carry along all those details by assuming a solar-centric point of view, it made it a simpler explanation.
So once you somebody came up with the solar-centric point of view, the explanation was so much more simpler, so much more simple. Occam's razor say, well, therefore it has to be true?
Not necessarily. I think the absolutes isn't an absolute principle.
Can you think of some others from the history of science where the simpler explanation replaced an older, more complex one?
It carries throughout. Newton's laws of motion. It really does exemplify, if there's one simple principle underneath most of science, it is the constant refinement of models to be simpler, more elegant explanations for complex phenomena.
It's interesting because you're a complexity scientist, and so what's the relationship between quote-unquote complexity with a capital C and the simplicity that we're talking about?
The point of complexity science is to study complex systems and look for the simplicity within the simple explanations, simple rules, simple phenomena, simple rules, simple models that explain that.
Suzanne, so how did this whole art exhibition? I guess it's more than just art. I mean, there's computer scientists and holographers and all sorts of people involved in this exhibition that's opening over the weekend. How did you decide to use Occam's razor as the theme and then draw people into it?
You know, when I saw the space after it had been remodeled from the old co-op and then the old graphics workshop.
At the Santa Fe complex on Agua Fria.
Santa Fe complex, right. It really looked like a space to do something more than an art show. And with all of that massive space, both wall space and floor space, I thought Occam's razor was the perfect thing to apply to it.
And so how, for example, in your own work and in the work of other artists who are participating, does that concept, does that rule, Occam's razor, come into play in the way people express themselves? Talk about your own work.
Yeah, you know, I'm presently working as a letterpress printer, and it's, I almost feel like it's great practice, but it's also required in the sense of setting type by hand into a press, and backwards and upside down, and in those ways you get simple, because you have to. So I talked about some of the pieces that were in the show from poetry, where not just haiku, but Miriam Sagan has a piece that's just words that can be read in any direction. And we collaborated, and I made Jacob's Ladders, which is the Chinese puzzle toy that also speaks to that, the simplicity of just words for her poem, Homeopathic Dose of Poem.
I was thinking about how Occam's razor applies to all sorts of things that really have nothing to do with science. For example, an explanation, like a child, instead of saying, I broke the glass, might say, well, the dog was running through the house, and then I ran after the dog, and then the pillow fell off, and then I tripped over the pillow, and then the glass broke. But it's, you know, that's a complicated explanation, whereas if you take the simpler one, it's a lot more likely that that's true.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that is where maybe trying to roll back 8 centuries or whatever, that may have been where things stood back in the day, was these elaborate, complex explanations that supported another agenda, a religious, theological point of view or whatever. And I think that's where science was trying to emerge, trying to say, no, we're really interested in what happened, not how to contort the evidence of what happened to fit your existing model of what you need to believe.
Well, I think that's such an important thing for everybody to think about, is the difference between what you want to believe and what you see in front of you, and noticing when there's a dissonance there.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting part about this show. I should make it clear, I'm not really involved in the show. My involvement is partly by being married to Suzanne, and the other is as on the board of the directors of the Santa Fe Complex. So I've facilitated some of it, but I'm actually outside of it and observing it and trying to understand what this implies, what the you know, what's happening here. Because the juxtaposition or the intersection of art and science is very fascinating to me. But I definitely don't have any inside understanding of what it means from an artistic point of view. And I'm hoping this show will help make that more clear.
Do you have collaboration between, that's part of what Santa Fe Complex is all about, is trying to encourage those collaborations between artists and scientists. Did any of that happen for this show?
Well, you know, the lines between art and science are, to me, very, they're not as distinct as, say, from another point of view. But there are several collaborations, music, sound, light, and vision. Help me out here. What else?
Well, there's definitely a lot of technology involved in the art.
In the show.
Yeah, the show, that is where art and science tend to collide or collude, is in the technology.
So like a hologram requiring lasers, but is an art piece.
Right. So all of this is happening starting this Saturday, October 18th, and the opening is from 4 to 8. There will be musical performances by the Smokin' Bocce Taiko drummers and a duet by Philip Mantione and Martin Back. Tell us about those two musical phenomena.
Well, you know, I just sat through the sound check yesterday of the Smokin' Bocce Taiko, and it's apparently very large drums and very loud, and they've written a piece specifically for this show, so I haven't heard that yet, but it promises to be a very exciting way to walk around an opening.
And then
Philip Mantione and Martin Beck, I also have not
heard.
That's
electronic music of some kind.
Yes, it is. I refer to John Cage-like.
Uh-huh.
And your co-curator, Aku, is the one that's made those connections, and
yes.
He's a drummer himself.
Yes.
And a marvelous artist.
Yes.
So this will be a very exciting event. Anything else that you want to let us know about?
Only that we would love to see as large of an audience, as broad of a spectrum out there as possible. We're trying to see how many people, unusual connections we can help make here in Santa Fe, which is a good place for making unusual connections.
The Santa Fe Complex is at 632 Agua Fria here in Santa Fe. You can find them on the web at sfcomplex.org. Suzanne Vilmain and Stephen Smith, thanks so much for being with us on Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. I'd like now to welcome Denise Cope. She is the author of Dying a Natural Passage, published by Three Whales Publishing here in Santa Fe, and she will be at Garcia Street Books on Saturday, October 18th, from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate being here.
It's nice to see this book published. We talked about it some years ago when it was a little spiral-bound, Xeroxed compendium of your observations over 40 years of being a nurse and working with people who are dying. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing thing that you got into that field so early. You were a very young woman when you were asked to care for your first dying patient.
Yeah, I was. I was a nurse's aide while I was going to nursing school. So it was really, when I look back, it's very clear to me that this was just part of my path, was to be working with dying and then to evolve into helping other people understand it so that they can embrace it.
You talk in the book about how even as recently as the 1950s, you never saw a pregnancy on television. You never saw people breastfeeding in public. That has come out of the closet and become a very natural part of life, as have many aspects of our bodies and our sexuality and so on. But death is still really much more difficult to talk about, to represent, to be open about. Why is that?
I think it's the mythology that we have in our culture. I think to begin with, you know, it's hard to lose a person. It creates pain in our heart. So then all of a sudden we've grown this thing in our culture about let's not talk about it and let's put it aside. And also people used to die at home. And then they'd be brought into the parlor. I remember my uncle being in the parlor, laid out in the parlor.
The parlor being the living room.
Yeah, in the living room. And then they started having hospitals, and all of a sudden, working with dying was relegated or turned over to doctors and nurses, and it stopped being part of the living experience. So it was behind hospital walls and really scary. And also, the other thing that is co-joined with that over this time is that back then, in the early days, people, the average age of a person in the 1900s was 46.
That was the life expectancy.
Life expectancy. So now...
When was this?
1900.
In 1900?
Yeah.
Good heavens.
Yeah. So now we're growing older and we're watching people die of chronic diseases rather than die of infections or heart attacks or accidents or at birth. So the type of dying that we're witnessing as a culture has changed.
How much of that is just simply antibiotics?
Oh, it's more than antibiotics. I think that part of it is that we're taking better care of ourselves. We stopped smoking. People aren't dropping over with cardiac disease. There's certainly, and much less lung cancer than there used to be. There are other cancers that have replaced it. But I think that it's how we're living our lives, that we're living healthier, and it isn't just antibiotics.
Very interesting. So even though many, many more people die in hospitals than they used to, mm-hmm. apparently people want to die at home.
Many people do. Most people would like to die at home. 80% of us die in the hospital. So then you have what we're doing. Some places, I just came back from Shreveport, Louisiana, and they have the most beautiful inpatient hospice. It doesn't make money for the hospital, but the whole community of 300,000 people know that that's there as an option, because in a lot of cases, people can't afford to do the caregiving. If it's an older woman and her husband's sick, she has to hire in private caregivers, or he has to hire in private caregivers. And that can get expensive really fast.
Very fast.
Hospice, most people think, oh, well, we'll just call in hospice, they'll take care of it. Hospice doesn't do the shift care. They don't do the care taking. They oversee the course of the illness, but they don't go in there and spend all day taking care of one person.
So who does that? I mean, if the person doesn't have a big family that's able to take the time off.
It gets tough. Either you pay for private caregivers, which is about $18 to $20 an hour, so that gets expensive really fast. Or there is a wonderful thing that we have in our community down at Southwestern, and it's called, I think it's Share the Care, right? Caring Can Be Shared. Based on the book, Share the Care. And if you have volunteers, friends, who will come together, they'll help you coordinate that caregiving team so that the burden doesn't fall on the family to coordinate it.
You write about death as being in many ways analogous to birth, in the sense that there is pregnancy and labor, and then instead of birth, rather death.
Right.
Talk about this process and how it is analogous.
Well, I started watching, and midwives actually have reflected, were midwives and have gone back into hospice, have reflected back to me. They said, this is the same process. And this one woman who was with her mom, she said, this is the same process as
amazing.
When I have my baby. And in the early stages of pregnancy, the mom, when she, number one, she changes her relationship to food. Now, with pregnancy and birth, it's usually some nausea, but there's a change in the appetite, and there is, the minute somebody knows they're pregnant, they're not so much interested in the outer world as they are interested in this new being that's inside of them. And what I watched, and what we watch in hospice with the dying person, when people say to me, how can I know if my loved one's dying, the first thing I ask is, have they changed their relationship to food, and have they had a weight loss? And that's usually indicative of it. That's one thing. And then also the dying person is going to be much less interested in the outer world. Once they understand that they're dying, what's really important are the people they love and completing whatever is incomplete in their life.
There was an example from, I think, one of your patients or somebody you knew who did this really wonderful thing, which was that the person knew that he was dying, and he had an event at his house where he was lying on a couch, and everybody knew he was dying, and just said goodbye to all of his friends one by one,
yep.
to say goodbye, to talk, and then when they left, he could really focus and be focused on by his family and
That's
nobody
right.
else.
That's right. That's right. And I have I know of another person who is planning to do that. And it's just one way of marking what this is about. I also have another patient who recently died, and he actually, he bought my book, and he sent it out to 20 different people as a farewell gift so that they would know that what he was going through wasn't quite so bad.
When you say it's not quite so bad, there are some real surprises in the book for people who have not been through this process with their relatives, let's say, or their loved ones, which is that dying itself is not painful. The disease that the person's dying of may very well be extremely painful, but death itself is a natural process which has its own safeguards against pain.
Yep, yep, absolutely. It's quite amazing. I've seen people with lung cancer who have no pain. I've seen people with other cancers who have no pain. Now, normally, cancer will result in some kind of pain, but not necessarily. I'd say 10 to 20% of the patients are going to be pain-free. And heart disease, unless it's angina, if it's heart failure, that's not necessarily going to be painful. Certainly lung failure, you know, chronic COPD. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which is usually emphysema related to smoking or some other lung disease. It's uncomfortable to not be able to breathe and distressful at times, but there are medications for that, but there isn't actual physical pain.
And so when the person is dying, let's go forward in this analogy to pregnancy. One thing that they start doing is conserve, they eat less food, and they conserve their energy. They pull inward, both
right,
psychologically and physically.
And emotionally. They're not so interested in what's going on in the outer world. They're not interested in their larger circle of friends. You know, the church people may not be so important to be with. Those people are going to still care about the person that's dying, so you can organize that team to support the process for the people who are the most intimate. I had one woman who just identified, she died when she was 51, I think, and she chose five or six of her friends, and she said, "You're the ones I want with me when I die." And when the time came, she just said, "Okay, it's time. Nobody else. Just you all are going to be with me."
And how did that go?
It went beautifully. She was so wonderful, and she was a friend. So I went. I thought, you know, I really want to ask her. She'll tell me what's it like to die, because I don't usually ask my patients that. And so I said, "So Mary, so tell me, what is it like for you? What's the most important thing for me to teach other people?" And she just looked at me almost beatifically, and she was at the point. We'd made the appointment for me to be there, and then when I got there, she said, "You know, I don't think I have the energy to talk." And I said, "Oh," she said, "I've gone down another notch." I said, "I understand. I'll just be here and maybe talk with your partner." But I did get to ask that question, and she just looked at me, and she said, "Just tell them it's all about the loving. It's all about the loving." She said, "I used to fuss at my partner about all the papers that were on the table and about this and about that. That stuff doesn't matter. It's about the loving."
There are so many lessons and teachings in illness and death that you talk about in your book that are really probably pretty darn useful for those people who are 25 and who are nowhere near death.
Mm-hmm. I had a young man, his mother had died and his father was dying, and somebody got my book for him, and he was in his early 20s. He said, why don't they teach us about this in school?
I mean, part of it is just simply, I mean, as you say, it's all about loving others, and it's also about, for example, taking stock, which is something people do during the last phase of their life, which they could be doing all along.
That's right. That's right. And it's also just about the physiology. I mean, to understand, I have this one physician's assistant who had worked in the ER, and I had an article at the time that was floating around on the web that this was the basis for this book, and she wrote to me and said, "I cannot tell you what a difference you have made in being with my father's death. I'm used to the ER where everybody dies suddenly or they live." And she said, "I didn't understand that there were natural stages, and that when he was starting to have pauses in his breathing, that wasn't when he was taking his last breath, and that was just a stage. That's what I call the labor of dying. That's the rhythmic change in the person that coincides to uterine labor." And she said, "Once I read that, I knew that we could rest, take a break, that it was going to be a while." And she said it made all the difference.
We're talking to Denise Cope, and the book is called Dying, A Natural Passage. And she's going to be at Garcia Street Books this Saturday, the 18th of October from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. So there's, I mean, we'll get to the labor part in a second. There's also, before the end, within, what, a few weeks or a few months of death, a lot of people have visions of people who have gone, who have passed away before them, or pets, or angels, or whatever. And those are not, you say, hallucinations.
No, they're not hallucinations. And I just came back from speaking to the family practice residents in Shreveport, Louisiana, at the university there, at the medical center. And I knew last time, I'd heard 10 years ago, that they didn't believe me. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go in and I'm going to find a common place to touch in with them. And I just expected that physicians, young physicians today, were taught that out-of-body experiences are pretty routine, that those happen. People report them. What they're about, we don't know. But people, it's common knowledge. I asked them how many in here have believe in out-of-body experiences. One hand went up, and it was a woman whose sister is in hospice. So I didn't even have a common ground. They just don't even have that belief system there to work with. So then I had to find other...
Well, and also they haven't observed it in their patients.
Not yet. Not at that age, no. And so it was really interesting to be with them and try and find that place where we could maybe talk about the fact that visioning happens. And the only thing I can find in the medical, and I've researched it, they talk about people having delirium tremens. No, terminal delirium. And I'm going like, it is not delirium. I said to the residents, I said, so what causes delirium? They said, drug overdose. I said, well, people when they're dying are not overdosed on meds. They are just visioning. And it's so consistently people who have died that the person knows who have died before them, and they're acting as a guide. And people are so reassured by who shows up. And like, the one woman told me, she said, you know, who showed up for my dad, his favorite dog. So, you know, it's, and sometimes it's like the out-of-body experiences aren't always 100% favorable. But, so, there was one man who saw the Grim Reaper. I did hear that story.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. The nurse.
That's scary.
The nurse came out to report to her supervisor. I was just talking to my patient, and he's seen this fellow, and he described him. It sounds just like the Grim Reaper. And, yeah, that could be scary, but for the most part, everybody has spoken about how they're reassuring. The person that's seeing sometimes needs to be reassured that they are not losing their mind.
And now, so, you have patients, you will talk to a patient who's close to death but still lucid, and they will say, there is my great aunt Sally sitting on the windowsill.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Or they'll just be talking to them, and then they just assume that person becomes as familiar to them as I would be in the room. It's just like it's natural. In the beginning, when they start to vision, they don't talk so much about it because I think it's pretty weird for them. But pretty soon, there's so much presence of that spirit, for want of a better word, that essence, that they start having conversations because it's just routine. It's just comfortable. That's just how it is.
Now, what about people who are super science people who don't believe in that kind of thing at all?
Well,
do they have them?
Yes. Bill was my favorite. When I first met him, he was a botanist. And he said, I'm a scientist. I don't believe in anything you can't measure, touch, feel, or see. I don't believe in any of that. And so we had some conversations, and that was fine, because we need to know where the person is when we go into that home. We leave our belief systems outside, and we only pay attention to them. So as he went through his dying, and he got weaker and weaker, he was in his 50s and was pretty miserable with his symptoms, and we were all seeing a lot of suffering and thinking, why doesn't he let go? Why doesn't this guy just let go? He was such a teacher for me that we so often as human beings project suffering on the person who's dying when they are not suffering. They're having a different experience in their body, and he was my big teacher for that. And at one point, because we're trying to help him get out of here because we think he's suffering, one of the nurses said to him, is there anything keeping you here, anything unfinished? And he looked at her and he said, oh, no, I've been given the gift of seeing where I'm going. And it is so warm and so beautiful. I just don't want to die yet.
So he saw the afterlife?
Yeah. What he saw and what I've learned, Mary Charlotte, is that it's almost the way I've kind of observed this. There's like this amorphous field, energy field around us, and I consider it as love-based. And then the visions that come to us are those visions that will have the most meaning to our hearts, to our personalities, to our life experience. So when I'm in the South, people are seeing Jesus. We're in the Bible Belt. When I'm in northern New Mexico, they're seeing, you know, Mary and the Lady of Guadalupe, because that has more meaning to them. For this guy, that wouldn't have meant a thing. But he saw a warm garden. He was an internationally known botanist. And so he saw a place that was warm and beautiful.
We're talking to Denis Cope. Part of what you do as a hospice nurse and as an educator about the whole subject of dying is not just help the patients, but help their families, mm-hmm. who are presumably at various stages of freak out or fatigue or just not knowing how to handle it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I have learned, and actually my cat taught me this. She was dying, and I thought, why am I so scared? I've been with my father's death. I've been with my mother's death. I've been with lots of deaths, and I couldn't figure out why I was so scared. She was dying of renal failure. I was a dialysis nurse for 14 years, so I wasn't worried about that. And what I realized is I felt so responsible for her, and I didn't want her to suffer. Now, with a person, I could ask, what do you want, what do you don't want, and I can check them out. But with the animal, I couldn't do that. And I thought, this is what people must feel a lot. And the fear that they carry to the bedside is, oh, I don't want my loved one to suffer, which is why sometimes we try and do things to prevent the suffering we're afraid they're going to go through that they're really not having. It's like when they sound gurgly in their throat, it's called the death rattle. All it is mucus that collects in a weakened throat. And people want to suction it out because for us it sounds uncomfortable. If you look at the dying person, they're laying there, they're quite peaceful, they're quite fine. Suctioning them is taking care of our discomfort, not theirs.
So in the very last day of life, there is a whole process. We don't need to go into it. People can read your book. But there is a predictable and knowable stage which relatives and friends can observe as breathing patterns and stopping drinking water and so on, so that you really know exactly where the patient is at.
Yeah, and people can, the other thing, the greatest mystery that I tell people when I'm teaching, the greatest mystery about dying is, I believe, for the most part, if not always, we choose our time of death. So,
What do you mean?
We actually decide when we're going to die. Now, we may not consciously say, oh, I think I'm going to go out and die today.
Well, I mean, would you say that if people are having a heart attack?
Uh-huh. At some level, that's what their life journey is about. I had this one mother, and she told me this after her son died. She said, I realized in looking back on it that he knew he was going to die that day. He came into the house, and I asked me for something, and then he said, goodbye, Mom. And she said, she said, you're just going out to play. And he said, goodbye, Mom. And he went out and he drowned. Now, it was clear to her he didn't suicide. He drowned. I have watched people last for months and want to get out of their body, and they can't. And I watched little mamas, my favorite. She walked off the airplane, walked into the hospital, got a diagnosis of lung cancer. You know, they did a biopsy. She got a diagnosis that day, that night. Paul and Adele, her family, were saying goodnight to her, and they said, goodnight, little mama. She said, goodbye, darlings. And they said, little mama, don't say goodbye, say goodnight. She said, goodbye, darlings. At 12 o'clock, the nurse went in. She was fine. At 12:30, she was dead. She just got out of her body. And how she did that, I will never know.
Well, you tell stories of indigenous Australian people and Tibetan people who say, okay, it's my time to go. They mm-hmm. shut their eyes. They do the inner whatever that thing is that we urban people don't know how to do.
That's
which
right.
is they just shut off the switches and they're gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Indigenous cultures, especially those who have spiritually evolved. I mean, Tibetan Buddhist priests know how to do that. What was it, the littlest emperor, one of those, the teacher of the little Buddha, he just sat down and he said, this is, and there's this wonderful.
How do we know? I mean, do we have teachings on how they do that?
If you took the time to learn, we could know. But it's people who've spent years and years in meditation, raise their vibratory rate, and they know how to connect with their bodies. You know, these people like in India who can lay down on the bed of nails, they know how to do stuff. But, you know.
Do stuff, I like it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like they know how to monitor their bodies. We don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do it. It's not going to be.
And you've been doing this for 40 years.
That's right. But I haven't done the in-depth study of this, there's a wonderful book called Graceful Exits that the woman decided she would look at how all these spiritual teachers had died. So she chose 108, which is a sacred number in the Eastern tradition, and she looked at Sufi and Hindu and what else? All the different Tibetan Buddhism, all the different religious teachings. And so it was across the board. These folks said, I'm going to be dying tomorrow, or today I think I'm going to die.
Wow.
And then they just died. And each story is less than a page long. It's a wonderful book to read.
There are people who are in so much pain that they want to check out and they want to do assisted suicide. What are your feelings about that?
I have my own personal opinion about it. I happen to be pro-choice at the beginning and end of life. I think what we do with our lives is our personal business. I personally would not suicide, but I know people who have suicided, and I totally understood why they did. There are other people who have suicided that for me has been a tragedy, but there are some folks where I go, I really can understand this.
And so they'll take pills,
or whatever.
Might take some medicine, but is the end process a whole different thing than what you describe when it happens naturally?
You know, I don't know what happens to people after they die suddenly. That, you know, it's unknown to us. I mean, they can come back, and family members will report, they say they're fine, they're doing okay, don't worry about me. But what actually happens, I did have one woman, now her mom was dying of cancer, I think, and we didn't talk about the fact that she was dying. We just talked about when she died. We weren't going to deal with that. And I respected that in that particular family. And the day that she knew that she could no longer walk to the bathroom, that's the night she died. She just said, that's it, I'm out of my body. Well, she and her daughter were very connected psychically. And the daughter was really frustrated that mom hadn't shown up for her.
You mean she wanted to have a vision?
Right, after mom died, she knew she'd come visit her. And finally, mom came after a couple weeks, and my friend said, Mom, where have you been? I really wanted to see you. And she said, listen, when we get over here, darling, we got a lot to do. It's like there's this orientation time. I don't know. And I also...
And it also makes it sound like time is the same, which I can't imagine that... I mean, if there is such a thing as an afterlife, that they would have clocks like we have.
Right. It wasn't 2 weeks. It was just that she had stuff that she had to do. And you know, in the Buddhist tradition, they talk about the bardos, that you go through these different levels and stages, and that's why they pray for people to help them through those different levels. And, you know, maybe she was going through bardos. I don't know what she was doing, but it took her a while to get in touch with her daughter.
So one of the things that one learns from this is that at a certain point, it's not about preventing death anymore. It's about really deeply accepting it, and this book is so helpful in that process.
I love what Ken Mayer wrote on the back. You know, he was used to be the president of Veterans for Peace, and he wrote, and it was the spiral bound version, this book enabled my late wife and me to spend our last 2 months together living instead of dying. Because they knew what it would be, and they knew what the different stages would be, and then they could focus on living.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe. Denny Cope is the author of Dying, a natural passage, published by Three Whales Publishing in Santa Fe. You can also go to her website, livingthroughdying.com, and you can go hear her speak at Garcia Street Books this Saturday, the 18th of October, from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.